gold and silver investments blasted into orbit for the third consecutive week amid weakness in the greenback. Welcome to Gold Seek Radio, everyone. Chris Walczek with you, beginning our 12th year here on the digital airways. Each day yields just a touch more sunlight to enjoy as we pass the winter equinox and chase away those winter blues. In similar fashion, the precious metals are off to an impressive start in 2017, with gold and silver higher around 5% in just the first 2 weeks. Our two guests couldn't be much more bullish on the precious metals, and we'd like for you to record your questions and comments on our voicemail phone number, 641-715-3900, and the passcode 514049. Jot it down or keep it on a post-it pad near your phone. GoldSeek.com begins now with a market weather recap. Visibility was virtually unlimited amid the third week of selling. In the U.S. dollar, gold added 2%, up $23, just shy of $1,200 at $1,196. Silver picked up a quarter dollar, 1.5%, finishing at $16.76 an ounce. The precious metals XAU shares ratcheted up 1.7 points, finishing at $87.02%, while black gold finished off, though, about $1.60 per barrel at $52, down about 3%. Still, the chart of West Texas Intermediate crude is bullish, presenting a solid case for much higher prices this year. On Thursday, gold rose above $1,200 an ounce for the first time since November, as investors and institutions poured funds into gold ETFs. It was the biggest jump since the U.S. presidential election. According to a Bloomberg report, holdings in ETFs climbed 1.6 tons on Wednesday. In related news, Baring Asset Management's manager has only one big market in mind for 2017, and that's the precious metals. The top money manager noted that central bank bashing by politicians seems to be a theme that will gain momentum this year, leading to safe haven purchases and higher prices. For instance, the president-elect remains critical of the Fed, creating what he calls a big bubble in the market by holding interest rates near zero, echoing the thoughts of UK Prime Minister Theresa May, who requested a change at the Bank of England monetary policy, as well as the German finance minister, who blamed the ECB for the bulk of populism in that region. The money manager has added $80 million of gold bullion to his $2 billion dynamic asset allocation fund, which outperformed 80% of its peers last year. Joining the gold bullish chorus, Jim Rickards, author of the New York Times bestseller Currency Wars, is even more bullish than before. He recommends at least 10% of an allocation in a portfolio in gold. And in recent interviews on USA Watchdog with Greg Hunter, he was even more bullish than that, calling for a cash ban and banking holidays eerily similar to Modi's India right now. In addition, the president-elect has the opportunity to shake up the Fed with new appointments, which traditionally leads to inflation. More good news for the sector. Precious metals bottom line. Well, the big news here on a technical vantage point was the XAU to gold ratio, which is wildly bullish indicator. In fact, there was never even much of a pullback in this indicator during the last half of last year. In addition, the CRB and crude continued to add further support for the bullish case for the precious metals. So there's some cuisine for cogitation. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, partly sunny skies persisted over the New York Stock Exchange as investors favored tech shares but shied away from U.S. dollar-sensitive equities amid a continued sell-off in the greenback. By Friday's close, the Dow Jones Industrials was down just 78 points, finishing at 19,885, still with its eyes firmly set on that 20,000 mark. The S&P 500 gave back only 2 points, finishing at 22,74 for the week fractionally, while the Nasdaq bucked the trend, adding 53 points, about 1%, around 55.74 at the close. A top story from Wall Street this week included a paradox. U.S. stocks are no longer the dominant actively traded security in the U.S. market. Instead, ETFs, which according to a Bloomberg.com report, took in $400 billion in the last year. That's a $4 trillion industry now. Each day, the Spider Financial Select, XLF, has an average trading volume of about 105 million shares, making it the fifth most traded fund and significantly more than the second most traded stock, Chesapeake Energy Corp. ETFs make up the bulk of the top traded shares. Bottom line on equities. The technical picture remains bullish for the sector as investors continue to shy away from interest-sensitive debt, and the rebound rally in U.S. Treasuries seems to be losing some momentum. Plus, investors continue to speculate on nationalist fervor running throughout the business sector, hoping to capitalize on policy changes in Washington. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with two big guests and Robert Ian. We'd like for you to stay with us. Peter Elides, editor and publisher of Peter Elides Stock Market Cycles, with his outlook on the markets for 2017. Welcome, Peter Elides.
Thank you, Chris. Nice to talk to you again.
Thank you. We've seen considerable inflows of capital from very nervous investors in Europe, the Eurozone, as well as in parts of Asia. U.S. equities have just been the market du jour, given in particular the U.S. Treasury route we've seen in recent months. What are your thoughts, right, please?
Well, it's been interesting, hasn't it, since the election of Donald Trump as the president. He's our president. He's had an incredible rally from Election Day, although one of the interesting facets of that, of course, was that as it became more and more apparent on Election Day that Trump was going to win, the market really tanked. It just went straight down. And again, proving the psychology of the marketplace and how it works amazingly, just turned around. And from there, it's almost been a straight line up. Where I think we are now, Chris, is again in a danger area. That's indicated to us in many different ways, not the least of which is some of the valuation principles that we look at. I'm very much a technician. I call myself an ivory soap technician for those that go back far enough. They remember that ivory soap advertised 99 and 44 one-hundredths percent pure. Well, I'm about 99 and 44 one-hundredths percent a technician. The other, the remaining percentage, I'll call myself a fundamentalist. But with those technicals in mind, let me quickly review the way I felt back in mid-2015. I thought we were at an area in the market that, because of a 33-year cycle from bottom to top, that it was indicating that we were either at or very close to a very important market top. As it turned out, in fact, I gave a speech to a Market Technicians Association in Seattle, Washington, on that day of May 21st of 2015, and said that I thought, indeed, that very day was going to be a very important top in the market. Well, it turned out to be for a long time. As a matter of fact, if you look at the New York Composite Index, which one could argue is one of the more important indexes because it includes every stock on the New York Stock Exchange, that index did top out on May 21st of 2015, and since then has not gone higher, save for one day, which happened a few days ago. So that stands out within that cycle of 33 years, plus or minus 6 months, as marking what I think will end up to be a very important market top. We've come to an area now where sentiment-wise, if you look at one of the longest sentiment indicators that we've had a history of is Investors Intelligence. That goes all the way back to the early 1960s. They tend to be very bullish if you read any of their commentary at Investors Intelligence. But even they are saying, with over 60% bulls at last week's reading and about eight consecutive readings above 55%, that that is very much a danger signal in terms of sentiment. So a great majority of the market analysts are showing themselves as being quite bullish here. And as we all know, once that tends to occur, it's not a perfect indicator because you can't say, well, any time it goes over 60, we're at a very obvious market top. That's not true. But there tend to be periods, market tops tend to occur at periods where we're over 55 or 60% for a length of consecutive weeks, as we have been for the last month and a half, with the cycle, this 33-and-a-half-year cycle that I pointed out, really indicates to me that this should be in the area, at least, of a very important market top. Let me give one counter-argument to that, however, and that is that the daily advance decline line of the New York Stock Exchange just within the last week has gone to a new all-time high. That argues against the fact that we have seen a final high in the indexes, because over over 90% of the time, perhaps 95% of the time, if we look at important market tops in the past, they occurred with a divergence in the daily advance decline line. In other words, if the daily AD line were making a new high along with the popular market indexes, chances are that's not a final high. So what that argues is that indeed we may be in the area of an important top. We may get some kind of decline from here, and within the next 1 to 3 or 4 months, I think, at most, another test of this area price-wise, where there is a marked divergence with the advanced decline line, that would convince me even more strongly that we are seeing a very important market top.
I think you've laid out a really good battle plan for our listeners. Any other thoughts on the markets?
Just that the importance of the potential top here. You know, usually we talk about tops as technicians or fundamentalists and say, yeah, we're going to top out, but of course the market always goes up, and chances are that this top will see a 20, maybe 30% decline, and then we'll keep going up again, and that's fine, and that's the way the market works. My warnings are this, Chris. This top, based on this 33-and-a-half-year cycle I talk about, which, by the way, goes back to 1802. It's not just a recent phenomenon in the last century or so. It's over 200 years old. The tops that have formed off this particular cycle have actually lasted for well over a decade. The average period has been about 14 or 15 years. So that becomes more dramatic. That says to people, you know, yes, this could be an important top, and I'm not just talking about the next year or two. This could be a top that, in terms of its importance, could last for a decade or longer. So that's how very important I think we should emphasize that this upcoming top might very well be.
You know, I think it's also important to point out that the market has been in this, as you say, upward trajectory now since 2009, the Great Recession, we were calling. Everyone's forgotten the moniker now. Solid 8 years. We've seen a few healthy corrections and sideways consolidations along the way. But if you're right, I mean, a lot of folks will be caught flat-footed because... And there are a lot of people upset with their bond returns, and they would be, I think, even more so if what you say comes to pass, because there's not many hiding places left. Anything come to mind?
There aren't too many places to go right now. I mean, there, as far as I'm concerned, when I look around us at areas of investment, there are bubbles virtually everywhere, thanks to the Federal Reserve's ZIRP policy, zero interest rate policy. And so I think... I hate to revert back to the old trite expression, but, and it's probably not as safe as it should be, but the money under the mattress simile comes to mind here, because I'm not very excited about too many areas where one can put their money in and rest assured that it's going to be safe, Chris.
Will there be safe havens that maybe we haven't even thought of?
Yeah, that's hard to say. There always are. It's so very difficult to pick them out ahead of time, though. I mean, it may be perhaps precious metals, although I think that because I believe we're going to be in a deflationary scenario, it's pretty difficult to argue in favor of precious metals also. I mean, you can argue that gold is the ultimate money and there's going to be value there. And, of course, we've seen some fairly dramatic pullbacks in gold over the last year or two, and so perhaps there's a buying opportunity there. But it's not one that I'd feel comfortable with.
We always appreciate your thoughts here.
What some people have accused us of being retired. We're not retired, but we do write a report on a monthly basis, and it's not on a subscription basis, however. So if people want to go to stockmarketcycles.com, they'll see our latest report on there that's available for, I believe the price is $19.95. Just keep in track, and if they want to be, in fact, notified for every time a new report comes out, because it doesn't come out on an exact basis of once a month, usually every 4 to 6 weeks on average, we'll be happy to put them on our mailing list and let them know in the next report. But that's the best way to contact us is through stockmarketcycles.com.
Could we add the toll-free number, the 800-888-4351?
Yeah, sure. That number is still in effect. My secretary, because I moved recently, is about 200 miles away from me. So it's difficult to keep in touch with her on an hourly basis in terms of what's going on. But, yeah, that number is still in effect if people want to contact us that way. But I would still say the best way to contact us would be through the website.
Great. Well, welcome to the digital age.
Always fun to talk to you, Chris. Thank you.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves. Industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank. And founding director, their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their RIA project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Dr. Lawrence Kotlikoff, hailing from Moscow, Russia today, professor of economics at Boston University, author of Clash of the Generations and the Inform Act. Welcome back, Professor Kotlikoff.
Thanks for having me.
I understand you have some colleagues there and working on a project.
Putting together a global climate change model of myself and a group of Russian economists. We've actually used this model to look at the impact of tax reform in the U.S., like the reform that the House Ways and Means Committee is considering right now, which would make some dramatic changes to the corporate income tax. And actually, the House tax proposal quotes three different articles I've written in its presentation of its proposal. So, as well as a co-authored book, that's our Get What's Yours, The Secrets to Maxing Out Your Social Security. That's a different book. The thing I was referring to was not actually now I think about it, it's not a book. It's a co-authored article with Alan Auerbach, who's a professor at Berkeley. Anyway, the bottom line is that there are some parts of this House tax plan which are really going to help the economy a lot. But there's some other features of the tax plan that raise some concerns about how much revenue it might lose. So there's good incentives for companies to invest in the U.S. under the tax plan, but there's some aspects of it that look like giveaways to companies that don't really need to be given freebies. So I think with some tweaks, it could be a great tax reform. So that's a good thing. There's not a lot of people saying good things about the Trump administration at this point for, I think, good reason, because we haven't seen a lot of, I think, really sensible appointments to the cabinet positions. At least everybody seems to have some sort of baggage associated with them, or lack of knowledge about what department they're supposed to be running. In this area, I don't think they're doing the a good job. And I don't know that it's coming from the Trump himself. I think it's really coming from the House Ways and Means Committee.
You have noted that Social Security is significantly underfinanced by, I think you mentioned, 33% or more. Keeps in line with the idea of some fiscal difficulties ahead. You've also talked about the budget office and spending on defense and Justice Department salaries, things of that nature. Do you think that we're still on the road to 200 plus trillion national debt when everything's included?
Yeah, the country's definitely broke. The Congress, both Republicans and Democrats, as well as the president-elect, don't seem to understand it. We do have this fiscal gap of what is now $206 trillion, which is the difference in present value, which is just the value in the present, of all the projected future spending, including servicing the official debt. All the expenditures on everything that the government's going to be spending, paying for, including gassing up Air Force One, you know, paying for Supreme Court justices' salaries, paying for the military, all the spending, Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, all that spending out into the future, present value it, and compare that with the present value of taxes, and we're short $206 trillion. Now, that's 10 years of GDP. That's bankruptcy. The country really is at this point bankrupt, but the politicians don't understand it. The public doesn't get it. Some politicians do understand it, but are too afraid or unwilling to tell the truth about the situation. So this is hardly the time to be losing any revenue and any tax reform. It is a time to fix the incentives to invest in this country, but also we should do it in a way that raises and doesn't lower revenue, and then we should also go look at the spending side and fix that as well. And I've, if you go to kotlikoff.net, kotlikoff.net, you'll see a book, in this case an actual book that I wrote, which is called "You're Hired!" exclamation mark dash a Trump playbook for fixing America. Now this book is about 100 pages. It's free. You can just download it, read it, send it to all your members of Congress and to the president-elect. And it has a sensible fix for health care, a sensible fix for Social Security, a sensible fix for banking, a sensible fix for the tax system. It's different from the tax reform that the House Ways and Means Committee is proposing, but it's similar in many ways to what they're in the at the bottom line, it's similar, but it doesn't lose revenue like their proposal seems to be likely to do. And there's proposals for how to fix part of the welfare system. We need to make sure that people have incentives to work. And when you look at our fiscal system, there's something like 20 different fiscal programs, each of which has their own tax system. For example, if you earn more money in your own food stamps, you can lose 23 cents on the dollar. You can lose 15 cents on that dollar from Obamacare if we keep that in place the way it is. You can lose 22 cents on the dollar on your income tax credit. So you can, you know, so if you're a poor person working at McDonald's and you have a family of four, you could easily be in a 60% tax bracket or even a 1,000% tax bracket if you earn enough money to lose your Medicaid benefits. You know, in some a lot of states, you're in a situation where if you earn a dollar too much, you can lose Medicaid for your, not just for yourself, but for all your family members. And that can constitute thousands of dollars of lost benefits. So what we're doing is we're trapping poor people and higher income people and, into not working, and poor people into poverty. And we're inducing older people not to work because of all the disincentives they face, including the earnings test from Social Security. So we need to fix not just the tax system, but Social Security and the healthcare system so that, and the welfare system, these four things together in a consistent way so that we give people the right incentives to work. And that's what I propose in this book. So I highly recommend everybody read this. It'll be an education about the true fiscal picture, but also, so it's not just that we're broke, but we have these terrible incentives to not work. You know, we've got this balkanized system that is giving people the wrong incentives when it comes to thinking about working. Who's going to work if you have to hand Uncle Sam 70 cents on the dollar? It's just doesn't happen. You have to really put all the understand all these different programs and put them together in one analysis to really see the true problem in this area. So I'm hoping that somebody down there in Washington will take a look at this book, fix things accordingly. I'm not optimistic. You know, I think that this set of politicians will be like similar former sets of politicians and keep driving the country into more and more red ink. The $206 trillion is a credit card bill. It grows with interest. So if we just sit back and do nothing, it's going to be $6 trillion bigger next year. That's the true deficit we're running. And the numbers that are being provided to us by the Congressional Budget Office are just really misleading, and intentionally so, because the members of Congress want to hide the truth about this problem. They don't want to reveal the fact that we're this much in debt because they want to keep getting reelected. So they like to cut taxes or increase spending. They just fight as to which of their constituents should get a freebie. But the truth of the matter is we're just leaving our kids with this enormous bill that's going to bankrupt them. Thomas Jefferson is surely rolling over in his grave because he was who railed against this passing the generational buck behavior. If you Google Jefferson and generations, you'll see quotes about his positions on this.
Exactly. He was quite the architect, I believe, writing into the literature that we must have sound money. I think they had just obviously witnessed so much of the economic turmoil in France, which was at the time an ally, a century of economic turmoil from unsound money. And I'd like to move on, though, to one of your recent comments here on the show. You pointed out your concern about the U.S. Treasury and obviously debt being a primary issue there, noting this months in advance of the Treasury collapse we've seen. Economists don't typically have the best track record as far as market timing and calls are concerned. We go back to Fisher, who called a permanent plateau in stocks just before the 1929 crash.
Yeah, I think interest rates still have miles to go up, and therefore bond prices have miles to go down, because the reality is when you're this broke, you print money, and we've been printing money. I must have said this on the show last time. The Fed has printed money out the wazoo since 2007, primarily under Geithner, Bernanke. Janet Yellen has stopped the printing of money, but there's all this money basically that's been printed that the Fed has then bribed the banks to hold in reserves. But the banks are free to lend out this money at any time. And as interest rates go up, they're going to start doing that. That means that all this money, about $2.3 or so trillion dollars, is going to get into the bloodstream of the economy. And that's going to raise this, what we call the money multiplier, back to where it was in 2007. And then as prices start to rise, the rate at which people transact, which is called the velocity of money, will go back to where it was in 2007. And if you have these two things happen, which is the money multiplier and the velocity of money return to their 2007 levels, we'll get an increase in prices of 300%. So we have the basis for hyperinflation created by Ben Bernanke under the heading quantitative easing. You know, Ben's a friend of mine. He's an economist. I've known him for a long time. Not a close friend of his, but he tried his best, and you know, his policy that he pursued was not what I would have done. I think it was quite dangerous. He felt it was important to get the country back on its feet, but you could argue that what he did was reckless when it comes to potential for inflation, and also might have scared the country more than it was scared. He and Hank Paulson together, he was a former Treasury Secretary. Bill, you know, when you look at the way they dealt with the crisis in 2008, when Lehman Brothers went down, they didn't try and calm the public. They said, this is a terrible crisis. We could have another Great Depression. Wall Street's gone crazy. We need $700 billion to bail out Wall Street. You could just as well have said, you know, if you look at the Lehman Brothers, Lehman Building, it's not collapsed. All the people who used to work at Lehman haven't died, a single one of them. So physically, nothing's happened. The building will get used by somebody else, and those people get hired by somebody else. So the real economy has not really been affected. If everybody gets psyched out and panics, yes, things will go downhill. But I wouldn't bet on that. So they left us in a situation where we can have hyperinflation and interest rates can go up dramatically and bond prices can fall dramatically. And I know this is a show about gold to some extent, and certainly gold should do better in that environment.
Do you worry at all, though, that interest rates might have a negative impact? It didn't seem to matter during the 70s, but the economic scenario here, the dynamics have shifted. We don't have the industrial base intact that we did then.
Well, I think the economy has been able to grow with high interest rates. It's been able to grow with low interest rates. It's been able to grow with inflation. It's been able to grow even with deflation. And if you look at the, I think, 1880s or so, we had about 15 years of high growth in the country and prices were falling. So there's kind of two questions here. What's going to happen to specific prices of specific securities like bonds, like long-term bonds? If you're getting 3 or 4% on a long-term treasury right now, 30-year treasury, and interest rates go up to 6%, you're going to lose a lot of money in those treasuries. Same with any long-term corporate bond or long-term municipal bond. So even if the economy, whether the economy is doing well or poorly, you're going to get hurt in that environment from those interest rates going up. But then the other thing, will these kinds of things, would high inflation or high interest rates produce a recession? I think a lot of this is psychological. So if people start pulling out their hair over high interest rates and high inflation, and they say this is the end of the world, then the economy can go into a recession, because if one employer gets it into their mind that the other employers are scared about the future, then that first employer is going to think that the other employer is going to start firing their workers, and those workers are the first employer's customers. And then the first employer is going to fire his workers, who are the second employer's customers. So you can get the entire economy to melt down, as we saw it melt down in 2008, just by having people panic, employers panic. So if you look at what happened right after Lehman Brothers went down, and we had the government, all these government officials, including President Bush, go nuts and suggests this was going to be the next Great Depression. The employers didn't wait around to see what was going to happen. They just started laying off people immediately. You had about 500,000 people being laid off per month for the first couple of months after Lehman's went down. And then it was up to around 700,000 by December. Lehman went down in September 2008. And by December 2008, we had like 700,000 being laid off per month. That's close to the population of Boston. not the metropolitan area, but just I think Boston and Burke. So I got that right. So psychology matters a lot to what happens. You're going to have the Fed talk people out of inflation or talk them into inflation for a while, but in the end, at some point, the realities of what's going on take over. So if the Fed has printed all this money, and at some point, if it does get it, it will get into the bloodstream of the economy and matter. Well, I think it's already happened. The fact that we can't structure, the fact that we can't, that we've been not keeping up with our nuclear weapons or shrinking our military in certain areas, or reducing our investment in research and development at the federal government level, or cutting back on healthcare in different ways, that is a signal that the country's broke. And that's the reality. The country is broken. You're seeing it through these different, you're seeing it in the potholes in the roads. You're seeing it in the bridges that are described by the engineers as dangerously out of repair, or as signs of a country that's in fiscal stress, doesn't seem to understand it yet collectively.
But really at the heart of it, you say, again, we're broke. I mean, you point out GDP just isn't enough to keep up with the borrowing. And you make this clear, we're not broke 10 years, 20, 50 years from now. It's today. What are the implications?
If everybody really understood the fiscal situation, that we're in much worse shape than, for example, as a federal government than, for example, Detroit, basically maybe like 2.5 times worse shape. They were underfunded by about 20%. Our federal government's underfunded by about 53%, meaning we need to increase taxes by about 53%, every single federal tax to pay for all the spending that we have planned to do. And I'm talking about every single tax going up immediately and permanently by 53%. You know, once once people collectively get that picture, then they're going to realize that that the government is likely to print money to try and pay these bills, because that's what politicians do in countries that are broke. They print money. You know, you saw this in 20 different cases in the last century. You had hyperinflations in Hungary and Germany and different countries, Argentina, Russia, Israel had hyperinflations, hyperinflation. Countries that get into fiscal trouble, the first thing they do is print money. And then you look at what the Federal Reserve has been doing, and it increased the money supply by about $3.2 trillion. I mean, it printed about $3.2 trillion over a seven-year period. And that's unheard of. You know, the basic money supply, the amount of money that the federal government had printed between the Federal Reserve had printed between 1913, when it was founded, in 2007 was 2007 was about $800 billion, and today it's about $3.2 trillion. So it wasn't an increase to $3.2 trillion. It's up to $3.2 trillion now. So it was about $2.4 trillion that was printed. So the basic money supply has quadrupled in the last 7-8 years, thanks to the Federal Reserve policy. So I'm not talking about excessive policy. I'm talking about a wild policy that the Federal Reserve has run, you know, something we've never, ever seen in the history of the country for 100 years. And then we see over this fairly short period of time, this decision to go wild with the printing of money, all under the somehow benign title of quantitative easing. What it's doing was easing the burden on Congress, the responsibility of Congress and the president to pay for what it spends. That's really what happened here. You know, all this printing of money didn't actually turn the economy around dramatically. You know, the recovery from the recession was extremely slow. I don't think we have yet fully recovered from the recession. We still have an employment to population ratio that's about 2 percentage points below where it should be in a normal recovery. So it's not like all this money printing actually eased the recession in any significant way. It just put us at risk. It kept the taxes down and the spending high, and left us at risk for high inflation.
You know, there's been considerable news under the radar screen that our policymakers are writing into legislature this idea of guaranteed income, and it seems to go hand in hand with the idea that the nation is broke, and perhaps even worldwide. The system appears to be broke in the periphery. Venezuela, horrible currency hyperinflation starting there, and then we have issues in India where the economy has been virtually shut down due to currency related, trying to go to a digital system. Do you think that this basic guaranteed income of some sort might become, you know, something we hear from our legislators?
Well, we have to worry about the automation of the of jobs. You know, the fact that smart machines are taking over jobs everywhere you look. So we've got kind of a winner take all economic system right now, where you've got these CEOs and getting absolutely astronomical salaries, and a lot of other people are not seeing pay increases for decades. When you have Amazon and Google telling us that they're going to automate transportation and the delivery of goods and not have any people involved in delivering this stuff, you know, we're going to have trucks that drive themselves and taxis that drive themselves. We're going to have drones that drop their packages in our front yard. We've got 7% of the workforce in transportation in our country right now. These people are going to be out of work. If you look at the local drugstore, there's nobody there. At the counter, you've got a machine you're checking out with. There's no toll booth workers anymore on the Massachusetts Turnpike, because they've just gotten rid of all those toll booths because it's all being done by a camera that takes a picture of your license plate and sends you a bill. So we have to worry about the income distribution. Now, a guaranteed income that's high enough to really take care of a family of four would require astronomical tax rates. So we need to make sure that we have a progressive system, but still maintain incentives to work. So that's what I thought about very carefully when I wrote this book, which again is called You're Hired, A Trump Playbook for Fixing America's Economy, which is at kotlikoff.net. How do you actually get a reasonable income distribution so that people that have been put out of work by these machines have something to live on? Because guess what? If they can't get some income, they will not be able to buy the goods and services that these machines are making. They won't be able to afford a car to drive through the tolls, the toll boothless highways, and pay the tolls, because they won't be able to drive anywhere. They won't be able to order stuff from Amazon because they won't be able to afford it. So this whole thing may not work as a macroeconomic outcome. The people at Amazon and Google need to think about who's going to buy their goods and services if they put everybody out of work. So we have to have, in this situation, pretty aggressive redistribution of money from the winners to the losers, so that the economy doesn't end up worse off. I've written papers about this, about robots. I wrote a paper that's on that same website, kotlikoff.net, called Robots Are Us, which shows that this process of automating jobs and having very smart machines who can do virtually anything a human can do can lead to the immiseration of the economy, that everybody in the long run can be worse off through time because of just what I said. People get thrown out of work or thrown out of good work, and then they can't afford to buy the products. And then in the long run, you have better technology, but you have less physical capital, and you end up actually with everybody being poorer. So we have to be concerned, but we have to fix things in a very precise way. So this is not a job for our amateurs. And the Trump administration so far has not a single economist associated with it. There's not a single academic economist who's been given any position, who's involved in the transition discussion. He apparently doesn't believe economists have anything to add. That's really tragic. We need economists at this point to help fix the country.
It's a great topic. We've been discussing it now for a few months on the show. But what's interesting is, I don't know if you saw the article just in the past week that showed a company in Japan just replaced something like, I want to say, 20 call center employees, analyst level, which has sort of been a stronghold against automation, if you will, or AI, whatever term you want to use. But what apparently they incorporated IBM's computer that, of course, won the Jeopardy show. In 2 years' time, reached break even. And from that point, they're saving over $100,000 per year net by replacing 20 jobs. And sure, that might make the shareholders happy as their shares increase substantially. But again, as you say, if there's no one to buy the cars, how have we really benefited? But is it really just a cotton gin scenario? I mean, you might recall it replaced approximately 50 workers, each cotton gin. And eventually those folks were redistributed throughout the economy. Are we crossing a new threshold here where we can't put those workers into productive positions?
Yeah, you know, it's hard to know. The cotton gin and the railroad are good examples of things that, you know, we have up till now, well, I would say up till about the 60s at least, been able to absorb new technology that took away jobs, but new things opened up. But it seems like the rate of automation has increased, and that the ability of these smart machines to do things that are very human-like has increased as well. So I think the nature of the technology is different, now that's coming along. There's very few things you can think of that a machine can't do, including rub your back and massage your back. You know, I'm a professor of economics. We could have a handful of economists provide lectures that are videotaped and then provided to every university in the country or the world, and put all the economists out of work. So it's not just actuaries that have to worry about this, but it's professors as well. Why do you need to have your own professor? Why not just watch a video of somebody else teaching? There's something different about the technology that's going on today. So I'm worried about it. Most people would have said, well, you're a Luddite. We've had technological change for a long time, and it's always been beneficial. But, you know, I don't see it these days. And I look at the real wages of U.S. workers, and the average weekly take-home pay of U.S. workers is basically no higher after inflation than it was in the 1960s. So the American dream has pretty well come to an end, that every generation would have it better. Yes, lots of rich people in the country have it a whole lot better, but the typical worker does not. We got to do something. It starts with sensible fiscal reforms and sensible banking reform, sensible health care reform, and sensible Social Security reform. And that's all in the book. So, again, I hope your listeners will take a look at the book at cutlercuff.net, read it, and pass it along, and maybe we can make a difference down there in Washington.
Thank you, Professor Kotlikoff, and we wish you the best of luck in your travels.
My pleasure. Thank you for calling.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves, industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank. And founding director, their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond. Your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Peter Alliades, editor and publisher of Stock Market Cycles, in the markets for many decades. It's a pleasure to have him back on the show. Welcome back, Peter Alliades.
Thanks a lot, Chris. I appreciate that. It kind of makes me feel old when you say many decades in the market, but it's true. I believe that we are, in terms of price and magnitude of moves, I believe we're very close to a market top. But having said that, I will also say that on the intermediate term, short to intermediate term, I think we are, in fact, we may be at a market top. But I don't believe it's going to be the final market top. There are so many things happening internally in the market, Chris, in terms of strength and breadth and advanced decline line and 52-week highs that intimate that if this is going to be a top, that it's not going to last very long, that there should be a higher high after this, or at least a test of these highs with the kind of divergences we like to begin to see at market tops. We have not seen those divergences yet, and that's one of the main reasons why it does not make sense that we're at a top here. On the other hand, if we look at things on a more fundamental basis, and I very seldom do that, but there certainly is a very strong argument, as you stated, that money has to go somewhere, and right now we look like the only game in town to a lot of people with a lot of money.
I wonder if you could tell your thoughts on the market sentiment. It seems a bit frothy. The put-to-call ratio and several other metrics just seem to indicate that maybe bullishness has reached almost a fevered pitch.
Yeah, I would agree with that also. I don't know as I go so far to say a fevered pitch, but it is certainly in many metrics as high or higher than it's been in quite a long period of time. In fact, we could argue that it's higher now and many measurement factors than it was at the highs in May of 2015 for most of the market averages. And let's also point out, Chris, that the New York Composite Index, which is theoretically at least the most broadly based of all market measurements with every stock on the New York Exchange, has not yet gone to a new high above the May 2015 highs. That high, by the way, was one that I did not think would be broken by either the Dow or the S&P. And now that it has been, I think we really are living on borrowed time here. I can see this extending into the fall. But, of course, the fall is only a couple of months away now. We get ourselves a decent decline here and then move back to these levels with, as I said earlier, the kind of deterioration internally in the market that I think is required to see an important top. And we may be looking at something that's a lot more important.
A few years ago, you could count on virtually a good, solid 3, 4, 5, 7% return on a diversified portfolio. Those days they're just gone. It's ancient history. You're lucky to earn 1, 2% dividend yields, of course, across the board on the S&P. And, of course, the price-to-earnings ratio, very extended relative to historic norms. We have the bond market as well reaching extremely frothy levels simultaneously. This just doesn't traditionally occur. Tend to be more negatively correlated, that is, stocks and bonds. Can you give us some reasoning behind it, or would you prefer to stick with the technicals?
Well, I think you've hit upon the exact reasoning for it, Chris, and that is that they're let's look at it this way. The people we have to feel sorry for, and I'm moving into that category myself, are the people that have worked hard all their lives, amassed themselves a certain amount of money that they figured they could retire on, a comfortable interest rate, conservatively gained at 5, 6, maybe even 7% if they were lucky, and they'd be set for the rest of their lives. Well, guess what they're getting now? You know as well as I do that they can't make 1% on their money. So if you're faced with that after these decades of hard work and labor, figuring you'd be okay if you amassed a certain amount of money, they now have to become seekers of market return, and they go out and do things they should not be doing. They should not be putting money in places where there is risk involved. But indeed, that's the only place where they have any promise at all of making money. So that becomes a huge problem, and it's a problem that in pretty big fashion and not too far away. But it's hard to put your finger on exactly when the price is going to start to be paid for all of that. I mean, what rising interest rates are going to do is finally make these people, the fixed income people that have worked for so long to get themselves some money they can retire with, a little happier. But on the other hand, that's going to completely rip apart our system that is so heavily based on debt right now, both on an individual consumer basis and on the governmental basis. So it's almost a no-win proposition, Chris, in terms of the next 2 or 3 years.
I don't think a host could ask for a better segue into alternatives to the paper assets, because chasing a yield is just a non sequitur at this point. It really leaves us in a bind as investors, and we start searching around for value, better relative value. And, of course, near the beginning of this year, investors said, wait, there's value, especially in a negative rate environment, over $13 trillion worldwide now in debt and sovereign debt going into negative territory. That really makes precious metals an intriguing alternative. And whether or not you like them or not, or whether you even allocate any to a portfolio or not, the story is compelling now after many tough years.
Yeah, I used to follow the precious metals markets a lot more closely than I do now, Chris. But certainly on a long time being around basis, saying that, you know, we know, although some people might argue, but gold is really the ultimate money, and that there is definitely value there. The question becomes, what are people willing to trade up for? What kind of risk are they willing to take? I mean, the old expression used to be that an ounce of gold would always buy a good quality man's suit. I don't know what that means anymore, because you can get a decent quality man's suit for $300 or $400, but the kind of quality that we're talking about may be more like $1,000 or $2,000 suit. So is gold overpriced here? I don't believe it is, but it's obviously in a situation where it faces what we might all be facing, and that is a deflationary situation. And I'm just not smart enough to know what's going to happen with gold in a deflationary situation. I can give you an argument for a move in either direction. I think the most important area to touch on, and it's not a timing tool, and it doesn't tell us where the market's going to be next month, next week, or next year, but we are, without question, once again, and it's happened now three times in the last decade and a half, in one of the most overvalued markets in history. I would encourage, I don't know if you ever speak to him in terms of interview, Chris, but I would encourage your subscribers and your listeners to listen to Hussman of Hussman Econometrics. He's got a website. It's free. It doesn't cost any money. Go and look at his interpretation of where we are valuation-wise, and he actually has a valuation metric and that has worked over a long period of time, over the last century, let's say, as opposed to the so-called Federal Reserve valuations and all these little game-playing things out there that really have nothing to do with true value or undervalued or overvalued measurements in the stock market. We are truly at one of the most overvalued levels in the history of the stock market.
Everyone listening to Peter Leidy's voice today will have links for you. Just click those links at the website or the email as you come across it. Really interesting information at the HussmanFunds.com. I think that's the one you're referring to.
Yes, it is. And he does a weekly commentary. I don't know what it's listed under, but it's on his main website. And I think it's under weekly commentary.
He shares your idea, basic premise on market cycles and themes and biases. Very interesting reading. So I hope folks will look into that there. We'll definitely put up the links there, as well as to Peter Leidy's market cycles as well. Hope you have an excellent summer sabbatical.
Always fun to talk to you, Chris. Thank you.
This is Robert Ian with GoldSeek.com Radio. With all the talk of unsubstantiated, disclaimer-ridden reports that are battling for credibility without evidence in the public's mind, with regard to alleged election hacking scenarios, there is one area each person should be acutely aware. And that is their voluntary authorization, which can lead to a blanket loss of privacy. Every time they sign a document or agree to a terms of service, and in the example I'm about to share, potentially lead to the permanent loss of privacy of their medical information. Every time you click that you agree to the terms of service, or sign an authorization for release of your medical records, you have potentially given away your privacy about whatever information you authorized that health insurance company to gather on you. I know reading terms of service legal documents is a boring exercise. Almost nobody does it. But when someone does read a terms of service or a blanket authorization, it can be a profound intellectual awakening. A close personal friend of mine just went through a living nightmare with their health care plan that ultimately required them to apply for new insurance elsewhere. And in doing so, sign a blanket authorization for release of their medical information. The insurer, who is a major insurer, provided inaccurate information via their automated system regarding payments due, while this person was away for extended travel. My friend sent in all the payment that was required, but upon calling them following the certified receipt of payment, was informed they were still a payment behind, so the insurer canceled them for non-payment. The insurer then said to send in the missing payment, and they would reinstate. This major insurer took the money, deposited the check, and actually said they had reinstated the policy, and prescriptions could now be obtained while traveling. But then, after a, quote, review, they rescinded and defaulted on their own representations by canceling the policy. What they likely discovered during their review, and in my opinion acted upon, is that this subscriber was recently diagnosed with cancer. When asked in a later phone call about taking payment, actually multiple payments, and telling the subscriber they were reinstating the policy, and then rescinding that decision, their handler of such matters for nixed subscribers said the original termination would remain in effect, and that the subscriber was somehow given a wrong impression from the insurance company's own CSRs, or customer service representatives. Apparently, the insurance company's own CSRs are only empowered to make requests of the reinstatement department. My friend was forced to make other life-changing arrangements and applied for coverage with another insurance company. As always, the devil is in the details. Never mind the discussions of political hacking allegations, when, for example, there is no real privacy with your health care information. And by default, you are essentially asked to give your privacy away in several steps. First, to the requesting company. Second, to the companies they may redisclose your information to. And finally, to other parties that may receive the redisclosed information, at which point you have potentially lost your privacy. Here's an example of what my friend was requested to sign on their new healthcare application. Authorization for the release of medical information. It says in part, "I understand the purpose of this disclosure and use of my information is to allow the company to determine eligibility for coverage and rate. I understand this authorization is voluntary, and I may refuse to sign the authorization. My refusal may, however, affect my eligibility to enroll in the health plan or to receive benefits if permitted by law. I understand the information I authorize the company to obtain and use may be redisclosed to a third party only as permitted by applicable law. And once redisclosed, the information may no longer be protected by federal privacy laws." I'll repeat that again. "And once redisclosed, the information may no longer be protected by federal privacy laws." That means that if someone gets a hold of your healthcare information from whomever it may have been redisclosed to, you may have little or no recourse. How many terms of service documents have you clicked and agreed to but never read. Not just with your health insurance company, but your bank, your brokerage, and others. The biggest hacking threat we may ultimately face may not be from others. It may, in fact, be from what we have already given away voluntarily ourselves. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week. The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves, industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garnero, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank. And founding director, their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice. GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.